This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. This episode continues the serialization of Dr. David Lankus's book, Expect More, Demanding Better Libraries for Today's Complex World.
Six, communities. Expect a platform. As you have figured out by this point, I am using community in a broad sense. I do not restrict the word to mean the public or a geographic locale. Communities are groups of people that have come together around some common variable. That variable may be where they live, or the school they attend, or the institution they work for. In all cases, I assume that members of a community are conscious of this variable, that they are deliberately part of a community. So if you attend or work at a university, that university is a community. If you pay dues into a membership organization like a club or professional association, that too is a community. Note that you are not restricted to a single community. You may be part of a community at work, part of a community where you live, part of a community that is a professional association, and so on. Not all communities need libraries. But in the communities that do need them, the library is part of the community, and you should expect that library to have a voice in improving the community. Communities have aspirations and dreams. You should expect the library to help refine and facilitate those dreams. Communities also have problems and challenges. You should expect the library to not only help solve these problems, but to document the way it helps. We also know a few things that communities should expect from their libraries. Libraries should be places for knowledge creation and sharing, not just consumption and checking out books. We know that the function of a library must transcend the boundaries of walls. Communities should expect libraries to provide services to our increasingly on-the-move population. That means that students should be able to access library services from home. Employees should be able to access their library from their smartphones. Citizens should be able to interact with the public library on the web, in the community centers, in the city hall. Library as platform. The new view of the library is not as a place or a collection, but as a community platform for knowledge creation and sharing. This is more than just a rhetorical shift. It has real implications for how libraries organize themselves and how they use technology. Let me give you some examples. Polaris Community Profiles. Polaris is a library software company, not affiliated with the ATV manufacturer, or the Star for that matter. It makes what libraries call Integrated Library Systems, or ILSs. This is the software that allows librarians to purchase new materials, organize them, put them on shelves, and check them out. It is, at its heart, an inventory control system. It matches perfectly a model of libraries as warehouses of stuff. That software you use to search for a book? ILS. Polaris gets that libraries are changing and is seeking to change with them. So Polaris went about designing a community profile system. The idea is that librarians could add community information into the ILS. In other words, they could add organizations with relevant information such as hours, contact info, and so on. Now you could search for a book on teaching adults to read, and up would come information about literacy agencies in the community as well. Then Polaris took the next step. Why not have the community organizations add their own information directly? After all, who is more familiar with the service of that organization and who has a bigger stake in keeping that information up to date? Now, local organizations could add their information and events and even use a set of pre-designed templates to create their own web presence, expanding their audience to library members and housing their web presence with a trusted local source that also provided training on running a website. Now you could find out about local children's foundations through the library's catalog, and the foundation would have a web address that it could help reach its stakeholders. What's more, the local organization could add related library resources to their page or link to their own sites not hosted by the library. For example, a local technology incubator in Syracuse that had its own servers could embed links to county library resources, including million-dollar databases on companies, patents, and the like. Polaris's ILS has become a platform that allows a community to share and discover services, and embed community-owned resources, like licensed databases of articles for research, within their local organizations. What's more, once the ILS was populated with organizational events, the library could share information on community happenings with any community member for new applications never dreamed about or developed by the library. One such application is an iPad app recently developed by a student at Syracuse University. The student plans to mount iPads on local buses. The iPads will determine your location and tap into the events calendar in the library's ILS so riders can explore what is happening nearby. Here's the library as a platform in action. The event information being used by the iPad app is not owned by the library. The app itself was not developed by the library. The location where the app and information are being used is not within the library. Yet without the library, this project would not be possible. Without a place, provided by the library, for the community to enter, store, and retrieve this data, the app simply would not work. We could take this community profile system one step further into the future. Imagine these local organizations are adding event information as part of their profiles. One kind of event they can add could be a class that they want to offer. Since it is part of the library platform, the class's profile page can refer to what is going to be taught and who will teach it and when. And it can also include library resources that will be used in the class. So a community member could discover a nearby class on her smartphone, register for it, and then get online readings and activities needed for the class all in one place. With the addition of discussion tools and video streaming, this system could evolve into a full-blown course management system. Public libraries can truly become the universities of the people by hosting open courses. But wait, there's more. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to see this same system in a higher education context. A professor could use their community portal feature to create his or her own course on the ILS of the college library. He or she would simply add the details of the course and then, with a simple set of clicks, add readings, media, and tools to the class. Add in grading and quizzes and voila, course management. Why do this versus going out and buying a learning management system like Blackboard? Well, the college already has a technology infrastructure plus a staff trained to maintain the ILS. Why build a separate infrastructure and silo for delivering courses? There is the added benefit of putting course materials into the hands of college personnel that are best suited to archive the materials over time and promote interdisciplinary collaboration. Usage of materials would go up, investment in IT would be leveraged, students and faculty wouldn't have to learn multiple systems, and the ILS is already well integrated into college systems like student records and IDs. Community Garden. Sometimes the platform the library provides has little to do with technology. In Cicero, New York, the library platform is built from the ground up, literally. Meg Bacchus is a librarian at Northern Onondaga Public Library, NOPL, and she is charged with developing programs like classes and events. To develop programs, Meg listens to the community. The community, it turns out, likes gardening, or rather, the community is interested in gardening and wants to know more. Rather than inviting some gardeners into the library for a talk, Meg decided, with input from the community, to do more. She brought together interested community members, and they built a garden they called the Library Farm. The community dug up and tilled a plot of soil next to the library. They divided the land into parcels, and people could check out a parcel for the season. Now folks with little gardening experience or without a yard could come and plant and get advice from experts in the community. This led to a series of talks and demonstrations, and all of them were grounded, sorry about that, in doing. Once the crops came up, the excess harvest was shipped to local food pantries. What started as a discussion of gardening became an expanded platform for learning about nutrition, buying local, and a whole host of other lessons. What did it cost the library? Water from a hose. Reorganizing the research library. I consulted with a large research library that was in the midst of reorganizing after an administrative death spiral. The dean of the library had been fired, morale of the staff was non-existent, and the provost had hired a new director to bring the library back to life. The new director had brought in consultants, including me, not to come up with a new plan, but to bless the one he had created, which was really good. The centerpiece of the plan was a reorganization of library staff, reports, and functions. Most libraries are structured into two big sections: public service, which includes everything facing the community, and technical service, the back office library operations. So when you walk in and browse the shelves or check out a book or talk to a librarian, you're using public services. The part you don't see, like buying materials, cataloging them, and maintaining the integrated library system, all fall to technical services. This model of library organization is so prevalent, you will find it in most academic and public libraries in this country. It is so widespread, you will also find it in Africa, Europe, and throughout Asia. Why is this model everywhere? Well, a lot of it comes from how we educate librarians, and a lot of it comes from an increasingly outdated model of library as book warehouse. Technical services are where the books come in, public services where they go out. But is this how your community works? Does this model match a more participatory view of communities? In creating his plan, the new director took a look at one of his target audiences, researchers. His was primarily a research-oriented faculty, but also included doctoral and graduate students and advanced undergraduates focused on the discovery of knowledge. The director found that a researcher needs to consume a great deal of information at the start of a study. The researcher needs background materials, examples of previous studies, and access to new concepts and theory. At this stage, the division of public service and technical service still makes sense, but as the researcher progresses, it begins to break down. For example, say a researcher gets external funding. Increasingly, as part of a proposal, researchers must lay out how they are going to collect data, how they are going to keep the data over a long period of time, how they are going to disseminate that data, not just published papers, but the actual collected data, and how they are going to secure any private information provided by people involved in that study. Libraries today actually have systems to do this. Normally, such operations are in the back office, technical services. The back office is also where libraries create a website around a project or store papers and conference presentations based on the study. Because the researcher only interacts with public services, he or she has a hard time getting the technical services he or she needs. The old division of what faces the community breaks down because the researcher is both a consumer and producer of information. The distinction between community-facing and back office also gets cloudy when looking at the teaching functions of a college. The faculty may be consuming information in the form of papers and media to bring into the class. They are also, however, creating their own collections of unique materials. How do these member-produced items fit into the library? Currently, they don't, and all this information sits on the hard drive of the faculty member who may or may not keep it, or may not leave it with the college when retiring or getting another job. So let's go back to the research library that hired me as a consultant. The library director threw out the technical services and public services model. Instead, he organized his services by research and teaching. If a researcher came in, he or she met with an assigned research librarian. Together, they went over the project, and the assigned librarian would organize the services of the library around the faculty member's project. The faculty member didn't need to know or care that it was technical services that built a website for the project. The faculty member didn't need to know that it was the reference department that did a literature search on the topic, or that it was actually IT that maintained a secure hosted data store to protect research data. Likewise, teaching faculty would meet with their assigned teaching librarian to go over instructional services the library could offer them, put materials on reserve for classes, and even request copies of textbooks to be added to the library collection. The library in this case became a human platform for accelerating the strategic goals of the university: better research and better teaching. In this example, however, folks were expected to come to the library. What if the library embedded itself in the community? E-science. In 2001, Alan Roche, a 24-year-old lab technician, entered into a clinical trial at Johns Hopkins University's Asthma and Allergy Center. The trial was investigating how lungs responded to chemical irritants. Researchers had Roche inhale hexmethonium. Roche was the third volunteer to do so in the study. The first volunteer had developed a slight cough that lasted a week. The second volunteer had shown no adverse reactions. Roche developed a slight cough that got worse and worse. 5 days after inhaling the chemical, Roche was admitted to intensive care. Less than a month later, she was dead. What makes the story all the more tragic is that Roche's death could have been avoided. As part of the funded clinical trial, the researcher did a literature search. He searched a database that indexed studies from 1960 to the present day. He found nothing on hexmethonium. However, Had he not restricted himself to the internet-accessible version of the database, he would have found studies from the 1950s linking hexamethonium to significant lung problems. Because of Roche's death, all drug studies at Hopkins must now include a consultation with a librarian and a pharmacist. This story is tragic, to be sure. However, I fear death by lack of information is inevitable. You will recall the discussion of the broken knowledge infrastructure. It is growing in size and complexity. Today, scientists are confronted by an increased body of evidence in databases, a huge growth in data available for study, more complex problems that are requiring greater collaboration with researchers in other institutions and in other fields, and whole new platforms for scientific investigation. Take, for example, the search for the fundamental particles of the universe at the Large Hadron Collider in Europe. The Large Hadron Collider is a loop of complex electronics and powerful magnets, almost 17 miles long, buried under the countryside in Switzerland and France. It has the ability to accelerate particles to nearly the speed of light and precisely smash them together. In the collision, the particles splinter and release fundamental particles like quarks and, hopefully, the so-called God particle, the Higgs boson, that gives the universe mass. The collider cost approximately $9 billion to build over more than a decade of construction. Needless to say, you don't build one of these for each set of scientists or universities doing physics research. Scientists from around the globe collaborate either virtually or in person to work the collider. To give you a sense of just how complex it can be to support this scale of scientific research, one article published from an LHC experiment listed 3,046 authors. These forces of large data and wide-scale collaboration are not limited to physics. Humanities scholars can now dig through hundreds of thousands of digital texts as part of their work. Social scientists are analyzing billions of web pages and social media updates studying how we behave online. Pharmaceutical companies can now generate millions of possible chemical combinations to fight disease, each one needing to be explored to make sure a new drug can help you, not kill you. To help accelerate science and avoid the potential disastrous consequences of information overload, a special corps of librarians is now being hired into laboratories. These librarians work directly with researchers to organize mountains of data, ease collaboration between virtual teams of scientists around the globe, and build tools to investigate a host of new questions. They are learning how to specialize their means of facilitation to the scientific endeavor. To facilitate access to the mountains of data being generated in labs, they use large databases and the latest search engines. They also use workgroup software and web conferencing to spread good ideas quickly among their teams. They provide researchers training on the latest collaborative tools and ways to seek out funding opportunities. They build a safe environment by ensuring that data is secure. They match the motivation of research staff by helping disseminate their work throughout the field. While we can't expect every librarian to wrangle 3,046 scientists or bring order to millions of points of data, we can expect librarians to go to the community. The community lives within and outside of the library, and so should librarians. From the sole librarian working in a small town to a medical librarian working in a hospital, you should expect your librarians to spend some of their time getting out of the library and into the community. Librarians should sit with the faculty, sit on chambers of commerce, and be at workplaces, not wait for the community to come into the library. Of course, there are times when it makes sense to expect the community to come into the library. We've just talked about embedding librarians within the community. What if we embedded the community into the library? Dallas Public Library. I mentioned before that a number of libraries around the world were organized in a single way, public and technical services. It turns out that they are physically laid out the same way as well. This is not an amazing coincidence. Libraries have been seeking standardization over the past century or so. These standards are ingrained in policies and even in the law. In Dallas, all branch libraries were built or refurbished around a master plan. The Dallas master plan dictated the number of square feet, the number and placement of stacks, the location of information desks, and so on. This leads to a sort of McDonald's-like familiarity. No matter where you go, you know what to expect. Except, even McDonald's has realized that reflecting local culture builds a greater feeling of local investment. Corinne Hill, director of the Dallas Library System, realized this too, and sought to shake up the master plan. In neighborhoods with a large artist community, she helped design libraries with gallery spaces and painting lofts. She worked with local developers to come up with libraries that reflected the community and look and feel. When talking about what these libraries had in common, she said that she put collaborative spaces in the middle and books around the outside as if they were art. Now, you might take this as a sort of dismissal of books as decoration, but that's not what art is for. Throughout history, art has sought to inspire, to educate, to provoke, and to remind. The books were not there for decoration. They were there to fuel the real work of the library, facilitating collaboration. She took one step further in designing her central library in downtown Dallas. On the fifth floor of the building was the Business and Technology Division. It was there to help people start, grow, and understand business. Corinne knew the community needed more, so she cleared out half the floor and replaced the stacks with work desks, whiteboards, and projectors. She wanted the space not only to refer to business, but also help business grow directly. She invited in local startups and let them set up shop in the library. She encouraged her own staff working on new ideas and projects to set up shop there as well. She embedded the community within the library. This model is not unique to Dallas. The Ann Arbor District Library has on staff a number of production librarians. Their job is to work directly with the community to produce new tools and projects. Someone comes in with an idea for a new website, the production librarians can help them build it. A video project? Production librarian. The library is a place for the community to create. Eli Nyberger, an associate director for Ann Arbor who oversees the production librarians, told me about a great idea. A community member came into the library and asked if his books at home could be added to the library catalog so people could borrow them. The member was more than willing to drop off the books if they were requested and thought other people would share their materials as well. In the way we currently think of libraries, this is an odd idea. After all, members' books are not owned by the library. But when you think of the library as a platform, and a library being of the community instead of for the community, it makes perfect sense. In fact, this pooling of personal collections is how many libraries in the country started. But why stop the community's stuff? Why not use the library as a place to share the entire community? Libraries around the globe are starting to loan out people. You could check out production librarians in Ann Arbor or a 3D printing librarian in Fayetteville. And some libraries are loaning out firemen and lawyers and accountants. The community experts want to volunteer their time, and the library can help maximize their efforts. In Europe, there are now prejudiced libraries where community members can check out a prejudice. Never talked with a Muslim, a gay, or a lesbian? A Latino, a Republican? Now you can. This works because the library provides a civic and safe space to have such conversations. Libraries as place. I've talked before about libraries as aspirational institutions. Communities, large and small, build libraries to be monuments as much as they build them to be functional spaces. Architects use libraries as portfolio pieces, rich in marble and mahogany. This is appropriate. The community should look at physical libraries as representative of their highest ideals. In the past, however, this has been, frankly, annoying. Libraries may be aspirational, but they still need to be functional. All those libraries that Carnegie built a century ago, many of them have been abandoned or repurposed because they are too small or too inflexible for larger collections, wireless networks, and new services. There are many librarians who groan when an architect is hired because too many architects see a library as a beautiful showpiece for the community to pose in and not a place where work needs to be done. However, that is changing. Why? The short answer is a new approach, detailed in this book, and Moore's Law. Intel co-founder Gordon E. Moore stated that either the number of transistors on a computer chip would double every 2 years, or the cost of putting the same number of transistors in the chip would halve. Moore's Law, as his theories come to be known, has held up for over 40 years. It has been used more broadly to talk about how technology doubles in capability or halves in price every 2 years. This can be pretty striking and has held up in study after study. A computer from 1982 weighs 100 times as much, is 500 times larger by volume, costs approximately 10 times as much, and runs 100 times slower than the average smartphone in your pocket today. How does this concept, or digital technology speeding things up and shrinking them down, play out in a library? Does the building get smaller? Of course not. But libraries of the past were infrastructure in which libraries would do their jobs. Today, that infrastructure is getting smaller and smaller. Encyclopedias that used to take up shelf space are now searchable from a computer. Card catalogs that would take up substantial floor space are gone. now searchable on the same computer. Microfiche is scanned and on the computer. This shrinking through technology has had big effects. The first is on the design of the physical library. Stacks of physical resources can now be compressed into smaller spaces, allowing robotic systems to retrieve them, like at the Joe and Rika Mansueto Library at the University of Chicago. The books and physical items are stored underground on shelves 50 feet tall and retrieved to a glass-enclosed dome above ground where the university community can meet and study. New building materials allow light to flood into libraries and make them innovative and inviting spaces. The second effect has been on librarians. Now the librarians can leave the building and facilitate knowledge. Most of their needed tools are available through tablets and smartphones. Libraries can recruit workers from all over the globe to aid in digitization, building web-based tools, and even providing question answering 24 hours a day because fast digital networks make telecommuting a reality. This may lead you to ask, as many communities have, whether we still need the physical library at all. The answer is up to the community. As the librarians need less and less space to do their work, the community needs more and more space to interact and create. Physical library buildings are being transformed into a third space. The third space is an idea put forth by sociologist Ray Oldenburg. The first space is where you live, your home. The second space is where you work, your office. And the third space is where you go to be part of a community. The third space can be a barbershop or a bar. Throughout Europe, it has often been the piazza, the town square. The problem with the third space is that it is disappearing. Even in Europe, piazzas are being redeveloped or overregulated. In the U.S., many third spaces are actually commercial spaces. So yes, Starbucks is a third space, as is the shopping mall. But these are regulated spaces for commerce that can distort the types of interactions and conversations that take place. Remember the Dallas Public Library branches? One of them was going to anchor a neighborhood redevelopment. When the developer was asked why, without prompting, he talked about Oldenburg's third space concept. He said he could build places to live, he could mix it with places to work and shop, but he needed a place for the community to come together and develop identity. For him, that was the library. The concept is not just about public libraries either. Universities are finding they need a place beyond the dorm and the classroom. Student centers are nice, but often students use the library as a place to be productive and social, because learning is a social activity. Many successful school librarians can tell you about how the library became a refuge for students who didn't fit in or who are seeking a place to bond with other students outside of athletics. Corporate libraries are interesting places that often mix company workers with people from other fields and disciplines that have come to use the resources and expertise. Government libraries, such as the Library of Congress, create fellowship programs to encourage scholars from around the world to come and interact with government employees and policymakers. The concept of the library as community space is hardly new. I've already talked about the ancient Library of Alexandria that was built with colonnades and rooms to maximize the interaction and discussion of scholars. Technology and a renewed focus on the community are allowing us to reclaim libraries for the communities. You should expect your library to be a community space, a place for the interchange of ideas and creation of whole new concepts. This, however, turns us once again back to your responsibility. A building alone can do nothing. Simply building a structure, no matter how grand or how representative of the community aesthetic, is not enough. Cramming a beautiful building full of books does not a library make. It takes a community commitment and a group of dedicated facilitators to truly transform brick and mortar into knowledge and community. Luckily, these facilitators exist, and we call them librarians.
And stay tuned in 2 weeks for the next episode of Circulating Ideas and the next chapter of Expect More. If you'd like to learn more about the show or listen to past episodes, you can visit circulatingideas.com or follow us on Twitter at @CircIdeas. We're also on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com, or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can drop us a line at mail@circulatingideas.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas.